to the end.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Skip to the End podcast. This week we're going to be reviewing the new David Fincher film, Gone Girl. We're also going to be talking about our top 5 comedies of all time, as well as our favourite guilty pleasure movies. So, boys, are we ready?
Yep, always.
Let's get started.
To start this week, we've got a great topic following on from last week, which is the top 5 comedies of all time. Adam, do you want to kick things off with your fifth choice?
Yeah, I'll start off with my fifth choice, which was Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery.
Nice.
I like this film a lot because when I was a kid, my dad brought it home from the video shop, which I believe was Movie Zone or something like that.
Beautiful.
One of the old shops. I think it's probably closed down now.
Other video stores are not available anymore, thanks to Netflix.
Pretty much. But yeah, he brought it home and I remember watching it. It's a very much a Mike Myers spoof of the exaggerated spy drama that we kind of talked about on the podcast with The Most Wanted Man, where it's not actual spy craft, you know, it's like James Bond back in the day, lots of gadgets, but it's a spoof of that. There aren't that many gadgets, and sometimes I think, you know, there's actually some great scenes in there where he's asking about gadgets and they don't exist. But I love that film so much. I mean, there's some absolutely hilarious moments, and it's all the kind of homages, I guess, to James Bond, where they're just taking the mick. Like, at one point, he's at a blackjack table and he's talking to one of Dr. Evil's henchmen, and the woman's called a lot of vagina.
Yeah.
It's degrading.
Which is, you know, and I think Random Task is one of Dr. Evil's.
Oh, it's the odd job.
The spoof on odd job, yeah. I just remember laughing all the way through it when I was a kid.
And yeah.
It's quite layered as well, because I watched it back as an adult, and there's a lot of jokes that you don't get when you're like 9, 10 years old. But as an adult, you think, oh, God, that's actually quite, you know, a risky joke to make.
I agree with you. It's a very good film. And it plays into something we spoke about, I think, on the last podcast, about comedy sequels having diminishing returns.
Yeah.
The first Austin Powers film was really good. The second one was pretty good. The third one was an abortion of a film that should never have been made or even conceived. And the worrying thing is, I'm sure I've heard that they're considering doing it.
Of course they are.
Yeah, but this is a rumour that's been going around for decades. But then, yeah, we said that about, people have said that about Anchorman 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, there's not going to be a second one. They've been saying this for 5 years. All of a sudden, 10 years after the first, I think, there is one.
Yeah.
So you never know.
Nice one to start it off with, Adam. Ben.
Well, I'm not going to do mine in any particular order. I've just listed them. So I'm going to start with Life of Brian.
Brilliant.
I have never been much of a Monty Python fan. Didn't really care for the series, and I don't really much care for the other films. But Life of Brian, the sort of spoof telling of the Jesus myth, is one of the outrageously funniest films I have ever seen. And I've lost count of how many times I've seen it.
I completely agree with you. It's actually one of mine.
I thought it might be.
Life of Brian is one of the funniest films I've ever seen. Just generally brilliant. Every turn there's kind of a joke there that plays into, as you say, the Jesus story, etc. No offence to any Christian listeners, but, you know, it's a joke. And
yeah, exactly.
It plays into the whole story quite brilliantly.
He's not the Messiah, he's a very naughty boy.
It's the idea that at the start, I think, there's actually two births, isn't there? So it's not actually saying that Jesus didn't, he's not saying anything about Jesus not existing. It's more about the fact that there was two people born on the same day.
They just happened to follow the other one.
Because there's a fantastic moment where he's giving, I think it's the story of Jesus giving the Sermon on the Mountain, and they're at the back and they can't really hear it, and I think one of them goes, "Blessed are the cheesemakers!"
Nice.
And it just, you know, it's a joker turn, and it's a great film.
It's a non-stop hilarious film, and I love it, and I watch it all the time.
Right, for me, I think everyone's list should have a Jim Carrey film. Me, Myself and Irene.
Yeah.
It's so good. Like, for me, it's wrong on every level. The character Milky, or Casper as it should be really called, is hilarious. You know, his son sort of being black when obviously his wife cheated on him with the, what's the correct term? Midget?
I don't think that's the correct term.
Dwarf?
No.
Little person.
Little fella. No, little person.
Okay, little person. Jim Carrey in that is outstanding, and you always forget that's Bridget Jones in that film.
Yeah,
who's walking around with a dildo, and
that's the scene that I always think of when I think of that film is where he doesn't realise that he's turned to Hank, his alter ego.
Yeah,
and he wakes up the next morning, he's got that big dildo, and he's like, "Oh, I used this on you." She's like, "No, you used it on yourself."
My favourite moment of that whole film is when he's in the supermarket and some woman pushes in front of him, and she sees and he notices that she's got some vagina cell or some brush cream.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Too much cheese on the tackle. Brilliant film.
Vagically.
But yeah, that film for me is Jim Carrey's finest, and I absolutely love it.
Right then, I guess it's my turn again now then. So I'm going to go with a film that I think a few people might not agree with, but again, it's more about my childhood and growing up, and probably a bad thing to admit this, actually.
Schindler's List?
Watching this as a child, but South Park, Bigger, Longer and Uncut.
That's a good film.
Fantastic.
Hey, relax, guy.
Absolutely incredible.
I suppose it's the fact that Adam was probably about 8 when it came out.
I was going to say, I think I was about 14 when it came out. Varys didn't know I watched South Park back then, but what a film. Absolutely. I mean, I just love the whole play on the apocalypse that they do. Satan's Rise. Saddam Hussein is...
Is the Blame Canada song in the film?
Yes, yeah, it is. It
yeah, that's good.
And that's the thing. It is essentially an extra long episode of the comedy show, South Park. But they really... I mean, Trey Parker and Matt Stone kind of... They did it right, whereas a lot of comedy series that do that get it wrong.
Simpsons, but
completely
yeah.
wrong. And they just... They kind of wrote a blueprint for everyone of how to do it. They mocked musicals... They mocked any kind of biblical end of days kind of.
I remember film. I remember they actually came out once because they. Let's be honest about it. They're so up to date.
They take. I think they write produce episodes in 6 days.
But yeah. their argument was we offend everybody, so there's no one being left out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like okay, well, it's fine then. So you can be racist or.
They even did
sexist or
an episode I think on like Family Guy and the writers, and the writers were manatees.
It was incredible.
If you take one ball out of the pool, the manatees won't choose any because either everything's allowed or nothing's allowed. But yeah, absolutely.
Great choice. Great.
Some of the songs are hilarious.
And I think Blame Canada was nominated for the best song at the Oscars. Because
really?
I'm pretty sure Robin Williams performed it live for them.
Amazing.
It's like, seek that out on YouTube. I'm sure that's what happened.
Ben.
All right, then. Now that you've said everyone should have a...
Jim Carrey.
A Jim Carrey film, I agree with that. And I think everyone should have an Adam Sandler film. But only this particular one. Happy Gilmore.
Yep. On my list.
Until I saw Anchorman.
Tap it. Just tap it.
Taboo. Until I saw Anchorman, Happy Gilmore was the hands-down funniest film I'd ever seen. Much like Anchorman, I think I could sit here with a pen and paper and write out the whole goddamn script. Top to bottom, it's hilarious. Adam Sandler's brilliant, but it's all the secondary characters, like Ben Stiller, as the nursing home warden, is unbelievable. Can I trouble you for a warm glass of... Trouble me for a warm glass of... Shut the hell up!
My hands hurt! Well, guess what? You've just pulled yourself... Now your back's going to hurt, because you've just pulled yourself landscaping duty.
You're in my world now, Grandma.
Happy Gilmore is... The only good film he's done. I mean, The Waterboy, you can make an argument for.
I hate that film.
Waterboy's a good film.
It's the best film he did. Happy Gilmore.
It's the high watermark for his career. The low watermark is...
Little Nicky,
or Don't Mess With The Zohan, or anything he's done since then.
So the low point in his career keeps coming. Like, he releases a film, it's the low point, then he releases one next year. That's the low point. It's even worse.
Scarily, I've got some news. We've got him on the show next week.
Well, at least we've been, quite kind about Happy Gilmore.
So next for me, I'm going for Old School.
Very cool film.
Yeah.
Frank the Tank.
From the moment it starts. How many decent quotes are in that film? You know what I mean? Both of you are silent. Do you not agree?
No, I'm just thinking, I like the bit when he says he's trying to avoid drinking at the frat party. He's like, oh yeah, we've got a pretty big weekend plan. I might go to Bed Bath & Beyond. I don't know if there's time.
I fucking need you more than ever. But yeah.
But I do agree that you kind of need a Will Ferrell film in there. I think he is one of those guys. That he's kind of love him or hate him as well.
I love him. I'm a massive Will Ferrell fan, but I could have had 5 Will Ferrell films in my top 5 quite easily.
I mean, there's not much else to say about this. Adam, your choice.
Well,
he's great.
I'm going to go on the subject of Will Ferrell there, and I'm just going to go with Talladega Nights.
Yeah.
For some reason, unbeknownst to me, I absolutely love this film.
Is that the Formula One one with
Ali
G? With
Ali G, Sacha Baron Cohen in it, and... It always gets to me. And there's some fantastic bits where they talk. I mean, they're good grace around the table, and they talk about what their favourite, like baby Jesus is my favourite Jesus, and it's just this brilliant mimicry on like the redneck American family who likes NASCAR. But yeah, it's got to be in there. I mean, that's probably... It's not my favourite. Will Ferrell from Anchorman probably is. But we've discussed Anchorman and we probably...
I'm liking the consistency of actors here. It's good. Now you're going to ruin it all, Ben, and pick someone completely different.
Well, all right, then I will do. I'm going to pick another great comic actor, but a more old-school legend. This is a great, brilliant Steve Martin film called The Jerk. Now, have either of you seen this?
I've not seen The Jerk, actually, no. I'm quite happy to take that on as homework.
Honestly, mate, you will not regret it. It's a film from, I think, 1979, and it stars Steve Martin as a guy called Navin, who... The film starts with him. He's destitute, he's a homeless guy, and he narrates basically the story of his life, and he's talked about how he grew up a poor black child. And the point of the film is that he was adopted by a black family, and at no point has he realised that he's quite clearly a white man. He's pretty sure that he's black, and then he manages by some quirk of fate to invent this product that you clip onto the end of your glasses to sort of keep them in place, and how you can remove them and stuff, and he becomes a multimillionaire. It's just about the sort of wacky adventure he has, and then how people then start to go cross-eyed from this invention. He has to pay them back. And there's a villain in it called Iron Balls McGinty, which is just one of the best villain names I've ever heard. But it's the best thing Steve Martin's ever done for me. It's hilarious. Seek it out if you've not seen it. And if you're going to have that as homework, Adam,
I'll take that as homework for sure.
Right, for me, next, it's going to be Wayne's World.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
As you said earlier, for Mike Myers in...
Austin Powers.
For me, growing up, one of my most watched films... The opening scene of Bohemian Rhapsody, all the way through it, the quotes, the originality. No, there's no films like that that come out in cinema anymore that are just original, that are just like nothing else.
I think what's interesting here is as well that one of his mentions is a comedy actor, and the other seem to have a film of his.
Well, we've had multiple Ferrell films, multiple Mike Myers films now.
Unfortunately, none for Adam Sandler past one, but yeah.
Technically, we all agreed on Happy Gilmore.
Wayne's World is incredible.
And actually, that is probably a sequel where it is still...
It's definitely not better.
It didn't really suffer from a law of diminishing returns. No. The jokes were different, the plots were different, and it's very good.
Yeah. And I love the fact we're not on, like, Wayne's World 8 now. They just left it at 2, leave it, walk away. They know it was gold. Yeah. Brilliant. And I don't think he's ever really beat that film.
There's a line, I think, in the second one, actually, maybe not the first one, where I think the woman's trying to get Garth to kill her husband, and she says... Can I be Frank? And he goes, as long as I can still be Garth.
Incredible.
That is such an old school slapstick vaudevillian joke, but it still works.
Up those stuff like Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Naked Gun. Leslie Nielsen is another actor that...
I wanted to put him in.
You could probably end up with a film of his in the top five. I mean, I must say, he's not in mine. He's another one of those actors. I mean, my next one is actually Cool Runnings.
Okay.
Great choice.
I hate this film, I must say.
Really?
Go ahead.
Racist.
I absolutely love this film. I watched it when I was a kid. It's incredible. I love it. It's
John
brilliant.
Candy, man.
John Candy is an amazing comic actor.
Yeah, I just find the film really cloying and overly sentimental. I can't stand those type of films where you know exactly what's coming at the end. Even if it wasn't a true story, you knew what was coming, and it's like, oh, God.
But I really did struggle, because it was between Cool Runnings and Uncle Buck
Uncle Buck
is incredible.
And Uncle Buck is one of those films as well.
This is
where you make this decision, and you've still got, like, 10 or 12 comedy films that you could have chosen in the top five.
Well, I do think in about a year's time, we should come back, do episode one again of our top five films, because you've already changed yours this week, Ben. And do our top five comedies again.
But I think we could all of our top five films change quite regularly.
Oh, easily.
Ben, you've got two left.
Okay, I am now going to go for another old film, but one that I'm expecting at least one of you to have in your list. This is Spinal Tap. Come on now.
Perfect.
The original mockumentary in my
list, but what a film.
A typical work of genius from Christopher Guest. The story of a fading heavy metal band touring the world. It's just one of the stupidest, most brilliant films that I've ever seen. And still to this day, just the thought of the line shit sandwich cracks me up. And if anyone's listening, they don't get that reference, go watch the film.
No, they can't print that.
And it's brilliant. And amusingly enough, the director and one of the stars of This Is Spinal Tap is Rob Reiner, whose father, Carl Reiner, was one of the stars and the director of The Jerk. So that's a little connection for you. But yeah, Spinal Tap.
He's also wearing a Shrewsbury Town shirt. You know, he's wearing the blue and yellow stripe. Shrewsbury Town.
Is that Derek Smalls?
Yeah.
One thing I love about that film is everyone always kind of mentions the turn it up to 11 kind of reference. But in that same scene, there's a bit where he's taking him through his guitars. And at one point, he's like, hey, can you hear the sustain? Can you hear the sustain? No, but it's not plugged in. It's just, it why are you asking him? And he's like, can we touch it? No, don't touch it. Don't even look at it. Turn away. And the guitarist, I can't remember the character's name, the guitarist, but he's absolutely hilarious, the entire film. And one of the things I love about the film is when Derek Smalls gets trapped inside the ice.
Yeah. The funniest thing out loud for me is when the guy's playing the piano and he's doing this beautiful piano piece. It's a really moving, you know, orchestral bit of music. And then the documentarian says to him, what's it called? And he goes, lick my lav pump.
Lick my love pump. Can I have a tattoo?
Can we forget about this podcast and just watch Spinal Tap?
Yeah, let's do it.
If anyone is actually listening and they've not watched any of these films, pick that one over everything else because that's the film that, to be fair, it beats everything else hands down.
It's hilarious.
I'm going to move on and pick a Kevin Smith film. Oh, I couldn't do five and not do this. And for me, Ben will want me to pronounce it Clerks.
Correct. We're not Americans.
Clerks. The original Clerks. Kevin Smith's debut. But for me, it's his finest piece of work. It was made from the sale of his comic books and got played, I think, at Sundance. And everyone from Tarantino to Rodriguez, everyone is always referenced in this as one of the most incredible debut films. I appreciate it's not the best directed.
He's point blank going to disagree with.
And I'm happy with that, because this is what it's about. It's not all
comedy is entirely subjective, of course. Yeah. But Kevin Smith is a fat hack, objectively. So that's
next week on the show. But no, Clerks for me is his. It's his finest piece of work.
I'm willing to stand in Mark's corner. Clerks, whatever you want to call it, is one of my favourite, the Kevin Smith film I actually like.
I don't like a lot of his films.
I'm probably half and half with him, to be honest. Some I like, some I don't.
Yeah.
There's stuff like Dogma, which I really like, and I like Clerks. I do like that.
Good. A little funny story about Clerks, which always makes me laugh. I went to university, you wouldn't think, and I was in a band then, and my guitarist said to me, what's your favourite films? I said to him, Clerks. This is no lie. Back in the days of, do you remember the illegal site LimeWire?
Yeah.
Which people used to torrent, which I don't ever endorse. I said to him, you need to go and watch Clerks. It's one of the greatest films ever. And he came back to me the next day. I said, have you watched it? He's like, no, I couldn't find it. And I was like, okay, next day, have you got it? He's like, no, I haven't watched it. For about a week, I kept badgering him. I said, James, you need to watch Clerks. He said, I've got it, but I started watching it last night and I turned it off. Every download I download is in black and white and really crap quality. This is what he honestly said. And I said to him, mate, it's a black and white film that cost about 20 grand and it's set in black and white. So,
that's true, yeah.
Little funny story, which isn't that funny, but hey. Adam, last choice, make it a good one.
I've not chosen something from him yet, so Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Dumb and Dumber.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
To be honest, anything from about 1994 to 2004... of Jim Carrey's you can choose in a top comedy.
He was just on fire, wasn't he? He could fart on screen, it was funny.
I'm pretty sure he did in Ace Ventura.
I think he actually did Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber in the same year. I mean, imagine that for two comedy films coming out in the same year.
For The Mask in a couple of years later, Don.
Yeah. The Mask, again. He was just kind of the pinnacle at that moment of comedy acting. But Dumb and Dumber is still to this day one of the funniest films I've ever seen.
Mark, yeah. Yeah.
Birds.
It's ridiculous, but it still works.
It was so offensive at point when they sold the budgie to the blind kid.
Yeah, yeah.
And you laughed about it, and then you actually think about it, that's awful.
I am really looking forward to the sequel. It's probably going to be the same as Anchorman 2, that it's just unnecessary and has no.
I have a bit more faith.
Yeah, the trailer was really good.
I like this because it's already technically have a sequel and a prequel, but just without.
Yeah, without them, so it doesn't
count. Without them, so we're saying now, this is the actual sequel, those don't count.
We will review that in a future episode as well, so that'd be quite good.
But yeah, that's probably my last choice, and Dumb and Dumber is one of the funniest films I've ever seen.
Some fine choices there.
My final pick then goes to another fairly old film from the 80s, I believe, called Trading Places, which is a film starring Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd.
That's a great film, one of my dad's favourites.
It's an unreal film. And the premise of it, for those that don't know, is that a couple of rich brothers, the Duke brothers, Wall Street guys, decide to see if they can take a rich upper crust chap, which is played by Dan Aykroyd, and swap his life with a down and dirty destitute played by Eddie Murphy. So they basically ruin Dan Aykroyd's career, they bring Eddie Murphy up, and they switch places, as the name would suggest. But then they eventually band together to destroy the Dukes, and it's so funny.
So moving on from that, my final choice, and in my opinion, the funniest film ever made, Napoleon Dynamite. There is no funnier film.
Gosh!
Dang it!
Hate it.
That's fine. Yeah. Now, this is a point that I was going to raise with you, and I know you hate this film. At university, I watched it once. I was like, this is the weirdest, terriblest film I've ever seen. Mate, so watch it again. Watched it again. It just clicked. It just clicked straight away. The funniest film I've ever seen. The most quotable film. It's incredible. You need to watch it more than once. I swear to you, once you've watched it once, go back and it'll just click. Something happens. It is like no other film out there. I don't know what makes it so funny. It's weird, it's quirky. The characters, the pace, the way it's filmed. The characters are so weird, but it's hilarious.
Well, I've got The Jerk as homework already, so I'm quite happy to go back and watch Napoleon Dynamite again.
Yeah, that can't count as homework, because you've already
seen it.
But just do it anyway.
Yeah. This is my most watched film, I think.
I'll come back next podcast with it then and just let you know what I think.
Cool. I watch this film every time one of my friends comes to visit, and we have a ritual that we always watch it, so I'll only watch it when I see him. And
oh, right, that particular friend, not everything.
No, not every friend, yeah. Rich. On my wedding day, my wife at the time, his wife-to-be, fiance, was really stressed getting her hair, makeup, nails, as they do. I'm in my house with my mum and dad, just chilling, watching Napoleon Dynamite with my mate, and he said, what the hell are you doing? Like, you need to get ready, you need to get your suit on and everything. I was adamant that the day I was going to get married was I had to start by watching Napoleon Dynamite, and I was late leaving so I could watch the whole film after the credits because there's another wedding scene. And I swear, if I have a kid, I'm not going to be there straight away. I'm going to watch Napoleon. If I get diagnosed with cancer and I'm about to die, brilliant, the last thing I do is watch Napoleon.
Does your now wife know the reason why you were late for the weddings? Because
I wasn't that late. I wasn't there early enough to be standing around and like talking to all the guests. I cut it really fine so I could get to watch it all. It wasn't like she had come down the aisle and was waiting, like, where's Mark? It was like, oh, dang it, I walk in. But
it is nice to know you had your priorities in line there, mate. So, well done.
We've had some really good comedies come through as well from Twitter, which is at STTE Podcast, and Facebook again, which is facebook.com/skipthempodcast. So we've had Natalie Brown has said Trains, Planes and Automobiles.
Yeah. Steve Martin again.
Yep.
And John Candy, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Amy Faye Hatton, Step Brothers.
So again. Actually, do you know what? That comes very close to Anchorman as my favourite Will Ferrell film.
Robin Grace, The Jerk, so he agrees with you.
No way.
Gemma Hurst, This Is Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Lois Netting Alexander, Bruce Almighty.
No. Terrible. She's wrong.
Stuart Pickering, Blazing Saddles. Racist.
Yes.
Racist.
Brilliant film.
And finally, Poochie 33, Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2.
Classic.
Unbelievable.
It's a horn part.
It's very pretty.
Yeah, just simple lines intertwining. You know, very much like I'm really influenced by Mozart and Bach, and it's sort of in between, though. It's like a Bach piece, really.
What do you call this?
Well, this piece is called Lick My Love Pump.
This week we've been to see the new film from David Fincher, Gone Girl. It's based on a novel written by Gillian Flynn. She also wrote the script for the film. The film stars Ben Affleck as Nick Dunn and Rosamund Pike as his wife Amy. The basic story is Amy disappears, and then it's about the suspicion that falls on Nick as to whether he has murdered his wife or not. Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the film, I do want to issue a large spoiler warning. We can't really talk about this film without discussing key plot points and the ending. So, for those of you who don't wish to be spoiled on this film, skip to the end of this particular section. Now, what I'm going to say is, I have read the book, and I know I'm the only one of the three of us that read the novel. So, before we get into the differences between the book and the film, I want to throw it out to you guys who didn't know what to expect. Okay. So, Adam, what are your initial thoughts on the film?
Okay, to be honest, I didn't really know anything about this film until about a month and a half ago. When I saw the first trailer, I thought this looks okay. You know, it doesn't look great. And then gradually my interest kind of piqued. So I kept up with it a bit. And eventually I kind of went in there yesterday thinking this film is going to be brilliant. And it did not disappoint. Yeah. This is an amazing film. It's, you know, twists and turns. The casting is one thing I want to talk about. We'll do that later.
Yeah.
But everything there seemed perfect. It's as if, I mean, you mentioned that the writer of the book, Gillian Flynn, actually wrote the screenplay as well, which was a very nice touch and probably the right thing to do for a novel such as this, because at least you get that kind of input of the original person's story. It's not someone else taking a novel and adapting it to screen. But everything just seemed perfect with it. I wasn't surprised, because I thought it was going to be good, but I must say, I didn't think it was going to be this good.
So what did you think of the story then, the actual tale of of the missing wife, the gone girl in question, Amy Dunn?
There's always kind of an underlying thought where it's all seeming a bit too simple. And then you kind of think, there's nobody. Even though you start to dislike Nick Dunn a bit, because you think, maybe he did do it, maybe he did. Deep down, somewhere, you know that this isn't true, he's not done it. So when she turns up alive, or it skips to her driving off into the sunset.
Sort of midway through the film, it's revealed that she isn't dead, she's faked her own death and framed
it. She's done all this herself. It doesn't come as a shock per se, but you just kind of sit there thinking, you cold-hearted bitch.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how you can write a character like that, who, although from what we've seen so far of Nick Dunn as the loving boyfriend, the doting husband, and eventually the bored cheater.
Yeah.
Who goes off and, you know, cheats with whoever and whatever. You start to feel sorry for him. You really do. And it's a really weird place to be in, because your perception just flips like that.
Yeah, that's because he's a bad man, but she is a worse woman.
Yeah.
So for all the bad things he did, like cheating on his wife, you know, that pales in comparison to faking your own death and putting all the blame on him, especially where the film's based in Missouri, a state that has the death penalty.
Yeah, and she actually wants him to... She even makes that last gift, the Punch and Judy, to show, you know, you're going down for this.
Yeah.
She leads him on not a treasure hunt, but like a anniversary day Cluedo game kind of thing, isn't it?
She puts clues and then he has to sort of solve a riddle to find the next
exactly,
clue.
Exactly, yeah, and she's just annoyed with him because the year before he couldn't do it, and then he starts cheating on her, and it all builds up to this crescendo of him on national television giving a special interview, and that's a moment which it kind of stuck with me after the film, when he's looking into the camera and he's not apologising to her for cheating. He's just trying to get her on side, and that's when, you stop feeling sorry for him in a way.
Yeah.
Because you realise that both of them kind of deserve each other.
Yeah. So what did you think about the twist midway through?
So, I'm really glad that we've took a kind of day to really think about this film. If we had tried to get my head and talk about this film yesterday, I'm still thinking about the film today. You know, it was so kind of refreshing to go to the cinema and it being silent for 2.5 hours. Now, I was like you, Adam. I didn't want to know any spoilers. I didn't want to know anything about this story. And I know, Ben, part of me wanted to go, but tell me what's going to happen now. I really need to know. The first twist that got me was the fact that Nick, obviously Ben Affleck, was doing the dirty on his missus. So I'm seeing this love story at the start of how they met Mr. and Mrs. Perfect, and he's going out. And the way they kind of met at some work convention or something, that you could see the chemistry was there, and they went outside, and it was so romantic. You know, the snow was falling, or there was sugar in the...
Yeah.
And he wipes the lips, and it was like the most perfect chick flick ever. And you think, oh, this is a really sweet film. Obviously, it's not going to stay like this. But the fact then that he was staying at the sister's house, and I genuinely thought, has this girl just gone missing? And I couldn't quite get my head around where it was going. And then there was that one moment when Ben opens the door and it's this young, probably 20-year-old that he's teaching, that he's having the affair.
Andy.
And that was my first moment of, I didn't see that coming. So I know, Ben, you've read the book, but that got me. That was a massive twist. I was like,
the revelation that he'd been having
an affair. I didn't think he had. I thought he was probably quite innocent and he'd obviously married a bit of a head case. Or this, because we had no idea. All we knew at this point was a table had been smashed in the lounge.
Yeah.
There was a bit of glass everywhere and it looked like someone had either come into the house and abducted her, or I don't know, someone had attacked her. So this first revelation that actually he is a cheat and he's got this new young piece of meat, that was one of the biggest twists for me. I was like, oh my God. And the way that...
Maybe you did do it.
And the reason why that works so well is the first half of the film, the flashbacks we see to their perfect romance, they are in the format of diary entries from Amy. So you're reading Amy's version of their storybook romance and then how everything eventually soured and so on. We later find out that because Amy set him up, she wrote this diary for the purpose of setting him up. She admits that some of the stuff towards the start about their fairy tale romance really did happen.
When he's being interrogated, he kind of admits that's true.
Yeah, like their original, when they kissed in this cloud of sugar, he admits it was true, and you know, some of the other things he said. But when we get to the point where, you know, we've had this one side of the story, this diary book style of how beautiful their romance is, that's why it's such a gut punch when you find out he is a dick.
It was horrible. Sitting there going, oh my Lord, this changes everything, and okay, he might have murdered her because he's got this new girl and he obviously wants her gone because he's got this new 20-year-old. And let's be honest about it, this girl was stunning that he had. He's one of his teachers and she was really full on with him. And then the next thing we see, he's trying to... I think he wakes up the next day after sleeping with her and realising that he had fallen asleep with her. Get out of the house, you need to go because he's staying at his sister's.
The camera shots for this were incredible. His sister is actually in the kitchen, which is kind of adjoined to the lounge.
You can't see it. He shuts the door and it's like, you bastard.
Standing in the kitchen drinking like a coffee, isn't she?
And the great thing about that is Margot, his sister, played by Carrie Coon. We talk about how that revelation that he'd been cheating on Amy with Andy was a gut punch to us.
Yeah.
Think of what it was to that character, to Margot, his sister, because she's his twin sister. Marvellously, brilliantly. Carrie Coon is I think, will be underrated. I've read reviews of this film when people rightfully rave about Affleck and Pye, which we'll come to later. But not enough people have spoken about Carrie Coon, who plays that role perfectly. She's his twin sister. She has absolute faith in him. And that's the first time when you can see her faith is shaken. Yeah. So, that came through the screen because that's how we were feeling as well. Because it was a revelation to us as well to her.
Because that's when their relationship doesn't start to break down, but it starts to become a bit more distant because she actually goes through the house and kind of confronts him, and he says, "Are you asking me if I killed my wife?" And she says, "I'll never ask you that."
One of the lines,
even though she was clearly implying it.
One of the lines that really stuck with me as well, I think later on when there's a bit more doubt and it really is starting to look like he might have done it.
Yeah.
He said, "Are you with me on this?" And she was, and her comment back was, "I was with you before we were even born."
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my God, you know, you can't be any more disrespectful lying to that person that's been with you forever. And it was. That moment for me, Ben, I had no idea that was coming, and perhaps I'm just a bit oblivious, but I was like, Ben, you've let me down. Now I'm starting to think you've murdered this wife of yours.
You're referring to Ben Affleck.
Yeah, not you.
I assure you, I'm
Yeah, innocent. Nick, I can't believe, I think you've actually, now I'm really starting to doubt you, and there's, well, then it all starts, doesn't it?
I was going to say, let's take a moment now to talk about the second half of the story. Then.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've learnt Amy's alive.
Yeah.
We've learnt she's given us this kind of monologue about how she's set this whole thing up so that he goes down for it.
Yeah, we go from her first-person diary entries in the past to her first-person narration in
exactly.
the present.
Exactly. And this, for me, this was one of the most chilling things, that to actually get back at him, she had planned to kill herself and bury herself at the bottom of a river so that she'll eventually be found and they'll think that he killed his wife and tossed her away like she was nothing. So that not only does America think he's killed her, they think he's just this heartless, ruthless killer.
Yeah, and if they hadn't given him the death penalty before that, they certainly would have found the body, yeah.
That was the, like you said, the bit that really kind of got to me was... It's probably about a 5-minute scene of the detail she's gone to. So it's like the revelation that she comes up with, like, I'm ready now to reveal. And when it's a really incredible 5-minute scene where she's going, from the moment I got the diary and she was writing it and they filmed how she was lying in bed watching him come in and having showers.
Befriended a neighbour.
Who was the idiot. She could fill with all these comments.
Stole her urine.
Because she was pregnant.
Stole her urine so she could falsify it to make herself seem pregnant, so that Nick had apparently killed his pregnant wife.
Yeah.
She went off and got all the funds that they had, dyed her hair, putting on loads of weight,
life
eating what she wanted.
Sign off on the life insurance policy.
Yeah, whilst he was watching TV, yeah.
it was, to the extent, I know it's obviously a genius story, but the that was like, oh my lord, this is next level.
I think that's the thing, because we don't, I mean, Gillian Flynn is going to get a lot of credit for this. I generally think that she'll probably get a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay.
I agree.
But, I mean, let's talk originally the novel.
Yeah.
To come up with all of this is unbelievable.
Yeah, and the novel, I read it only recently, only a couple of weeks ago, and I blazed through it in a couple of days. It's a really good read. And the film is very, very true to the novel. There was some worry that they were going to apparently change the ending, and they haven't, to be honest.
I think that might have been a curveball.
I think it was a curveball to throw people off. They've retained the ending. And it's a brilliant film, and it's a tricky one to translate to film, because all of the book takes place as a first-person narrative.
Yeah.
So you're either dealing with Amy's diary entries or just the first-person thoughts of Nick. That means that only half of that directly translates to the film. We've got the first-person diary entries of Amy, but Nick we're watching from a third-person perspective.
Yeah.
So it removes the concept of the unreliable narrator. In the book, Nick is saying things, and you're thinking, well, he's saying this. I don't know whether he's telling the truth or not.
True.
In the film, however, we're watching it happen, so we know the truth. So you guys, you had a different view on it because you hadn't read the book. Whereas I, for example, when Nick first walks into the house and he sees there's been a struggle and things are knocked over and glass is broken, your guy's reaction would have been probably fairly ambiguous. You didn't know at that point whether he'd done it or not.
No.
In the book, the way it's written, because it's first person, you absolutely have no idea whether he's done it or not. Whereas I, watching it in the film from the third person, from the way he reacted with shock and then ran around the house looking in the other rooms trying to find Amy, it was obvious to me that he hadn't done it.
Yeah.
If he had done it, if he'd set it up, he wouldn't react like that in a room where no one else was. He was on his own,
yeah.
So he wasn't putting on a show for anyone. So for me, that changed it a little bit. Whereas in the book, I had no idea whether he was guilty or not until halfway through when Amy was revealed to be alive. Whereas in the film, I knew he hadn't done it because I'd read the book, but I think I would have had a strong inkling that he hadn't done it based on the fact that why would a human react with panic in their own house with no one watching them? So it changed it a lot, but it still worked.
The portrayal of the media as well.
Yeah.
And how they've kind of reacted, because originally they're unsure, and then because he's snapped in one or two moments where he's smiling. Because at one point I think a journalist shouts, "Give us a smile."
Yeah.
He smiles and they get a photo, and then that's you know, 1 millisecond of his life where he's smart, and all of a sudden that's plastered everywhere.
And they're laying
Can't believe
him.
He's smiling next to a picture of his missing wife, he must have killed her, blah.
Yeah.
And for me, there's one reporter in it who just constantly goes after him for it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know how you'd react in that situation, because it's being splashed over. And the media, once they start reporting something, you have your idiots out there that just believe it straight away.
Of course,
like that.
Yeah. And one of the best things about that particular reporter, I think her name was Ellen, who she kept going
Ellen
after
Ellen Abbott, wasn't it?
Ellen Abbott kept going after him in the media. They used footage or stuff that the camera people had got of Nick and his sister Margot together, and they started insinuating that they were having some sort of incestuous romance. They were like, they're very close, aren't they? It's like, well, yeah, they're twins.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the portrayal of the media there. They're just showing how fickle they were, because towards the end of it, they loved him again.
Yeah,
let's interview you now and we'll get you out of the shit, really, wasn't it? It was a case of, like, we're here for the exclusive to show that Nick's the good guy and they're now trying and everything's great. And it was like...
So let's talk about Desi Collins then, who comes into the film after Amy gets... She's living in this kind of trailer park.
In a cabin.
Cabin. She gets all of her money stolen from her by these two people living next door.
Yeah.
So she's run out of money. She ends up on this casino boat after calling up Desi Collins, who's an ex-boyfriend from boarding school.
Yeah, who she had previously claimed or had told her parents and told Nick... was besotted with her and used to stalk her, and then he tried to commit suicide when she left him and all this sort of stuff. So she then calls upon him as the only person she can call to prey upon him. Yeah.
So he ends up taking her back to this lake house, which is probably the coolest house I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's
actually.
Unreal.
That's where Iron Man would live.
Yeah, it's on technology.
That's where Iron Man
would
holiday.
Yeah, it's technology everywhere, but he's got cameras watching every door, room, and it's a bit weird. It's a bit of an intrusive thing. Now, I've not read the book, but I've been told that it's heavily implied that he's kind of a closet homosexual in the book.
I don't know. I think he's just a dandy. I think he's a fancy boy. I don't think he's meant to be gay.
Because they say that he never really kind of sees her as... He just wants her as kind of a trophy wife, really. He wants her to live at his... Because he makes no moves on her. He makes nothing like this, you know, not until
you're
ready.
He seems a bit freaked out as well when she's really coming on to him. He was a bit uncomfortable when she was trying to take his top off. Let's calm down.
Yeah,
let's
he
slow
wants
down
it to go
this.
Slow, yeah.
So it's kind of implied, I think, personal point of view that maybe that is the case. But in the end, you know, she seduces him or whatever, but not before setting another plan in motion to ruin another man's life.
This is it. She realises that her way out of this shithole that she's dug is to go back to Nick as this sort of rape victim. So she forces a wine bottle into her vagina to stimulate the...
She actually cuts the glass first.
Yeah, yeah. To make it look like she's been raped. She then has sex with him, so he's obviously, his fluids are in her.
Yeah.
She then slices his throat with a box cutter, Breaking Bad style.
Pretending it was the only thing, only option she had. So she, drives back home, pulls up on the drive, the media frenzy's there.
Yeah.
Because they're all parked outside his house waiting for
him. Puts on a big show of hugging Nick, who leans in lovingly and then whispers in her ear, "You fucking bitch."
Again, I never saw, at this point I was like, I have no idea how this film is going to end. I kept looking at my watch thinking there's about 20 minutes left of this film.
See, that's what I was going to say. At that point, when she comes back, did you think this is going to be the end? It's going to be a really dark-ass ending?
Yeah.
Well, I had this...
I wasn't expecting
it. Yeah, I think I had this feeling that she was going to come back, hug, covered in blood, and then something weird, like you say, he says, "You fucking bitch." They go into the door shuts, and the credits come up, and it'll be like... "You arsehole, Finch. I want to know what's going on here. Don't leave it." But then I looked at my watch and thought it was another 20 minutes. Yeah. And then I was thinking, but that's not long enough.
And I had a very similar thing reading the book, because at about that point in the book, there's about 20 pages left.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, well, clearly something else happens. What is it? So my thought was, Nick's going to kill her. Nick's going to stand for this.
He's
either
going to
kill her or he's going to prove... What she's done, because Nick at this point he's brought in a lawyer, Tanner Bolt, played by Tyler Perry.
We'll talk about that later.
We'll talk about the character, the actors later, and he's also got Detective Boney, Kim Dickens, who was the lead investigator who suspected him of the crime initially but realises that he was framed. He's got those guys working for him. So I thought at that point, after she returns home, he was either going to smash her head in, and
get
kill her,
some proof,
or get the evidence with these guys and get her locked up. But then the actual ending happened. So what do we think to what actually happened at the end, guys?
It's set by the tone of the film, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, she ends up essentially manipulating him to stay with her.
Yeah.
But manipulating to stay with her as the man he pretended to be. Because the whole seemingly point of this film is that when we're in relationships, we're not ourselves.
Yeah.
We try and play up to the expectation the other person has of us. So... I mean, she's basically saying to him at the end, "You're fake, I'm fake, why not just pretend with the people who love each other."
She does a monologue in the film, and there's an extended version of it in the book, where she talks about the concept of the cool girl. The cool girl is the girl that every man wants. She's the girl that drinks beers and will talk about football and all these sorts of things. And she's saying about how that's how she presented herself to Nick when they first met. That's what he fell in love with. She fell in love with the guy who reacted well to that and would treat her well and would treat her with kindness. And then as they both changed, as she became her real self, who wasn't the cool girl, and as he became the slovenly bugger, cheat that he was, they fell out of love. And her, being an absolute sociopath, she decided that she wanted the artifice. She wanted to go back of being the fake perfect wife and him being the fake perfect husband, because that was more important than the reality. And then, as you say, she manipulates him into staying with her by... There was a point earlier on the film where it talks about how they had... they had tried to get pregnant, and Nick had stored some of his sperm away.
Yeah.
And she then one day decided she didn't want to get pregnant and threw his sperm away. Turns out she hadn't. And she then used it at the end of the film and said, "Well, I'm pregnant now." And he decides that it's better to stick with this woman for 18 years for the sake of his soon-to-be newborn child.
Daughter.
Rather than expose her and deal with the fallout. So he ends up staying with this woman.
When his sister finds out about that, and she breaks down and's crying, then... she is literally absolutely devastated for him. You can just see her pain. Like, "You're going to suffer for another 20 years.
That's when she says, isn't she? "I've been with you since before you were born."
And that moment is like, even at that point, she still won't turn her back on him, even though she's so disgusted by that decision and so feels so sorry for him. My God, unbelievable.
It's a great film, and the acting performances are brilliant from everyone, I think. There's a weak link in it.
Yeah.
But the moment where she manipulates him by saying, he's like, "I'm going to walk out that door now." She's like, "Yeah." And the media's going to have a frenzy with that. Your wife comes home after being kidnapped and raped and you walk out on her straight away. And it's just the way she keeps him there and keeps him there and keeps him there.
Yeah.
And then eventually impregnates herself with the sperm.
Yeah. And he's stuck with her.
There's a moment just while she's just returned. They go into the house. She's kind of cleaning the blood off her and stuff. And they're having that conversation just before they do the interview back. and she's really winding him up by showing the power that she's got, and he suddenly slams her up against the wall, and I think he uses the C word.
And she uses it
at
well.
That moment, literally the cinema jumped.
Yeah.
And I just, you could hear a pin drop. I was like,
everyone was,
what's
gripped.
He gonna do? Is this him losing the plot? Is he literally gonna turn around and just slice her throat or something? Is he gonna beat the hell out of her, knowing, but then my heart stopped.
That's great. And the moment when the first night she spends home is brilliant, because he kind of puts her into bed and the shot, you can stay here, and he's like, no. And he ends up going into the spare room, but he doesn't sleep.
No.
Yeah. He literally sits in that chair.
He locks the door and sits in the chair holding
the cat.
It's like a horror film, isn't
it?
It's like you're in,
he's
you're
just
in
sitting there thinking, if I go to sleep,
you're locked in a house,
she'll
with
kill me.
Freddy Krueger.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, that's the film. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that it was pretty bloody good.
And
you've referred to the acting performances a few times, so do we want to get into that?
Yeah, so Nick Dunn,
let's
Ben
start
Affleck.
From the top. Ben Affleck, it is the best Ben Affleck acting performance I've seen. But that said, I like Ben Affleck as an actor, I always have.
Oh, yeah, I do.
I think Ben Affleck's issue is that he's done a lot of shit films.
Yeah.
It's not that he's a bad actor. And the one thing about Ben Affleck I think that people or react badly to is that he has kind of a superficial, smug charm about him, which can put people off. But that was
perfectly
Nick.
Perfectly works.
That
in
is
this
perfect
film.
For Nick, because Nick is this guy who people, they hated him because he didn't seem distraught enough that his wife was missing. He was a bit too smug, a bit too laid back. And Affleck nailed it. Like that bit that you mentioned where he smiles for a millisecond.
Yeah.
And Affleck puts on this sort of little sideways smirk and you're like, that, brilliant, it's perfect.
It's that smile that gives you enough reason to doubt his story.
Yeah.
Because I jumped on the media about how they kind of jumped on it as well. But you do, because you're sitting there and you're thinking, you smug twat.
Yeah.
And you think, maybe he did do it, you know. And he's the perfect guy for that role, because he's like the typical American cornfed country boy,
he's
that guy who's, you know, all the women are going to love at high school or college or whatever.
Yeah.
He's got that smug arrogance about him, and that for me seemed perfect in
when I was reading the book. As I say, I only read it a couple of weeks ago, so I obviously knew Affleck had been cast, and I'm reading it and thinking, this is perfect for him, down to the point where in the book they even refer to him as having a cleft chin. It's like, he's got a cleft chin.
Yeah. Did you hear when she said, when she met him as well, like, you've got a superhero chin?
Yeah.
Well, that's going to happen in that as well.
Right, Rosamund Pike.
Hey, you don't even ask me my views on Affleck.
Sorry,
forget it.
Come on, talk to us.
He was better in that film with Jennifer Lopez.
Definitely not.
Julie Orbiters.
Brilliant. Amy Dern, Rosamund Pike.
We're talking about Ben Affleck. What do you think, Mark?
Ben Affleck's finest performance ever on film. Ever.
Yeah, brilliant.
Even better than Chasing Amy.
That was worth it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right, Amy Dunn, Rosamund Pike.
I thought it was the best performance in the film. And she's one of those people that I've seen in a few films. She was in one of the James Bond films. She was in World's End.
I don't know.
That Simon Pegg film wasn't great. She was in that. And she's always perfectly serviceable, clearly a good actor. But in this film, she was... You believe the first half of the film where she's just this slightly prim and proper but lovely woman. You believe all of that. And then the second half of the film where she's this sociopathic bitch.
Yeah.
You believe that she's a murderer.
It's that shift, isn't it? It's just... all of a sudden, everything turns on its head. You hated Nick Dunn. No, you don't.
Yeah.
You loved Amy Dunn. You thought, she's beautiful. She's had this upbringing where her parents have kind of traded her off against... this book character of her that they've wrote.
Amazing Amy.
Yeah, and you feel sorry for her, but you love her because she seems so real and so down to earth. And even though she's this trust fund kid, she's like, she's the cool girl. She's the cool girl.
Yeah.
And then it just, literally everything just turns on its head.
She should be up, I hope, for an Oscar because she was 10 characters in that film.
I think Affleck and Pike are both getting nominations.
Pike will get nominated for Best Actress. Ben Affleck could and should get nominated for Best Actor.
Ben Affleck, he's kind of got that Matthew McConaughey syndrome now, where it's changed, and now hopefully he'll do a lot more serious roles. He's changed. He's not gone from that heart-throbbing Armageddon and all that. Now he's like, I can actually act, and there's more about me. So I'm really hoping... I know he's got to do Batman next, but I hope we see... I know he directs a lot, and let's be honest about it, he's bloody good at it.
Yeah.
But I'm really hoping he does another serious... Maybe Fincher will get him involved again in another film.
I think Fincher will, you know.
People talk about Argo and his direction and how good a film that is, but they don't talk enough about his acting.
His acting is really good in that as well.
And The Town.
And the towel, yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I like that. He's kind of done this. He's moved away from the heartthrob films. He's gone into serious acting. And
Clerks 2.
He's very good at it. Not Clerks 2. Yeah. But he's very good at these roles. And I kind of look forward to seeing him in his next film.
Oh, me too. Well, you know, next film, whether it's Batman or something else.
Or something else.
Yeah. It actually makes me want to see Batman more now, because I'm thinking, well...
He seems like he's going to play a more serious Bruce Wayne.
Although I still think he's only going to be in it for about 3 minutes, but that's...
Let's talk about his sister then, Margaret.
Well, we've spoken about Carrie Coon quite a bit, and she had some of the really powerful scenes.
She was underrated.
No, she won't get the talk that those guys... Yeah, I mean, she won't get a nomination, although I think she'd be fully deserved. The two scenes that we've mentioned is the scene where Nick wakes up in her house with his girlfriend Andy, and the way it's filmed, beautifully filmed by Fincher, you don't see until Andy's left that Margot was in the room the whole time, and the way she treats that scene, just how devastated she is that she's been lied to. And then that second scene that you were talking about, Mark, towards the end when Nick tells her that he's going to stay with Amy, and she's there on the floor crying, devastated.
It's two of the most powerful and emotive scenes, I guess, in the film, because, like you said, I mean, there's a lot made about their relationship. Even the media talk about how close they are, but you are kind of having this inside view of their relationship. And when he's been cheating on his wife and hasn't told her, you sit there and think, well, they're not that close then.
Mm.
But then that last moment where she's sticking by him despite the fact he's staying with her, that's when you realise, no, they are really close as brother and sister.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to talk about Tyler Perry.
Yeah, because the lawyer.
What a cool guy.
Tyler Perry is one of these guys, so I only have one memory of him, that's Madea, that character he plays in comedies that is generally awful, and South Park have parried it as well.
Tyler Perry is a playwright. That was his original job. He used to write plays in his hometown that always revolved around this Madea character, which is him in drag, and they're always about family and about spiritualism. You know, they all go to church together, it's all that sort of stuff. And then he managed to transport those onto film, and he's made seemingly dozens of these Madea films now, which make a hell of a lot of money with the black community. But people don't really respect him because they see that as kind of hollow and he's not really done anything else.
He was parodied in South Park. Yeah. They did a big thing about it.
So when he was cast in this film, it was something of a shock.
Yeah.
And I was intrigued to see what he'd be like. And he was really, really good.
He was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Because Tanner Bolt, the character he plays, is this hotshot lawyer that's known for defending men who killed their wives and getting them off.
Yeah, I think this might be his first actual innocent client.
Yeah, exactly. but it makes Nick look worse because Nick hired the guy who gets murderers off.
Exactly. So but he had no other choice. Yeah. He had to go for this guy. And the guy even says, I've got a $100,000 retainer fee.
Yeah. So Margot had to remortgage out.
Yeah, she had about $40,000 savings, remortgage out. Yeah. But he's brilliant.
Yeah,
I was really surprised.
So cool, so believable, so funny as well. Really liked him.
There's a great scene where he's kind of prepping him for the interview and he's going through the speech, and when he's like, every time you look smug, I'm going to throw a gummy bear at you.
Yeah.
And he just keeps throwing these things at him. And it's just, even though he's probably only in it for about collectively 15 minutes in scenes, he kind of just...
He controls it, he owns the scene. Trial, when everything changes and she comes out and they're sat having a coffee and even with the officer, he owns that scene.
Yeah.
He's just there, like, I think it's the moment he leaves.
Yeah.
He's saying, well, I'm done now, there's nothing else I can do to help you. He just stands up, gets his briefcase, goodbye, and he walks out.
He says to her, you've got a book deal and you've got all this, I think you should thank her.
Yeah, and that's it, that's the harsh reality. Like, you were skinned, you're going to be minted now, you've got her back. Mate, my work here's done. Yeah. He walks off. It's like, wow.
He's absolutely brilliant. The one thing that annoyed me about Tyler Perry's casting, however, is that in a recent interview, they asked him about how he came across this role. He's like, oh, my agent gave me the script and said you'd be good for this. And he then went, if I'd have known who David Fincher was, I wouldn't have done it.
Oh.
And he then went on to explain it. And what he's this guy who's quite closeted. He only knows his own particular type of film and type of stuff. He's not familiar with David Fincher's work. And when he says, I wouldn't have done it, what I think he meant was, it's too big for me. It's I don't really do these blockbuster films.
So it's come off a bit wrong.
It made him sound like a dick. But he didn't mean it, because he was talking about how great an experience he had and how good a film it is.
I think he's going to get a lot of credit for this film. And I think there's a lot of people who are going to be looking at him now thinking, this guy can do it. Drop this silly Madea stuff that you've been doing.
Put the wig away.
Yeah, stop that. Yeah. Come on, come to Hollywood. Do some serious stuff. I mean, I can see Fincher using him again.
Yeah. Fincher does like to repeat people, so I wouldn't be surprised.
There's other performances in this film. Neil Patrick Harris as Desi Collins. He's not in it for long, really, overall, but he plays the role well enough.
Yeah, he's good enough. I thought Kim Dickens was really good as the Detective Boney, yeah.
For Desi, I could switch off and sometimes when I see someone that's on a TV show that I hate, I can't switch off and think, actually, that's still that annoying guy from...
What's How I Met Your
Mother. Yeah. And I did switch off and I forgot it was him.
Yeah. I mean, he played the role well and, you know, he deserves credit for that. I think, like we've mentioned about Tyler Perry and Carrie Coon and Neil Patrick Harris, although their performances are good, you know, Carrie Coon and Tyler Perry's case is great.
Yeah.
They're always going to be overshadowed by Affleck and Pike.
Yeah, they own this film.
We should give a shout out to, what was the guy that played the officer from Almost Famous?
The cop in this, yeah. Patrick Fugit.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, he's not done a lot. So in Almost Famous, he's the young kid, one of his greatest ones. I think since then he did, we bought a zoo, which was a little small cameo.
Is that the Affleck one?
Yeah, no.
Matt Damon.
Yeah, and nothing really happens. He's just a little side character. But I thought he did well. He's obviously secured quite a big role from not doing anything for a few years.
Interesting enough, he was kind of the character that was always sure Nick Dunn was guilty, wasn't he?
I liked his little
investigating the case.
I liked his little cocky comments as well. And
he was always sort of digging at Nick.
Do we want to talk about Fincher a little bit? What do we think to the direction?
Pretty good.
I thought it was his least flashy work that I've seen recently. Like I always think back to Zodiac. There's a really good.
I've not seen Zodiac.
You've not seen Zodiac?
No.
Holy moly!
Homework.
Yeah,
dude.
And I've ever been told is it's one of his greatest films, and I have to watch the director's cut.
Whenever
I see that, there's never anyone goes watch it. Everyone says the director's cut.
And get the DVD or Blu-ray because excellent, because there's like a making of featurette that's brilliant. It talks about his process and his shots, and there's this one sort of top-down slow car chase, and it looks like, do you remember the old Grand Theft Auto games, the top-down view? And it looks like that, but it's brilliant, and you see how he puts it together. And this film doesn't have the flash of that, or even The Social Network, which, you know, for a film about a website, had more flash to it than this does. It's a lot more basic, but it didn't need it, because the story stood alone. It didn't need flashy direction. It was beautifully directed.
I think flashy direction would have taken away from this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this is a very much a gritty drama thriller that is set in suburban America.
Yeah.
It doesn't need flash.
How nice was it that we had no special effects?
Yeah, no CGI.
No green screen, no CGI.
It didn't need any of it. It was so real. It was
all
so
about
raw.
The acting.
But Fincher, I mean, he's not hit and miss, but he does bad films, he does good films.
I think, I'm not sure if it beats Seven for me.
See, now I haven't seen Seven.
Homework.
Which is, well, yeah, has to be, doesn't it?
There we go.
All right, cool. My homework is Seven.
Brilliant homework this week, boys. Phenomenal. I really want to see Zodiac and Seven, so yeah. I won't talk about what happens in Seven because it's one of the biggest spoiler films. But
even if you've not watched it, you don't know.
I need more time to fit, and I want to see this film again, but it might be my favourite Fincher film. I absolutely loved it.
It was brilliant. A couple of other things that I just want to hit before we wrap this up. The music by regular Fincher collaborators, Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor. What did we think to the score?
I think Trent Reznor should quit Nine Inch Nails. Stop and just stick and focus on this.
He could be huge in this.
Yeah, well, he's already won an Oscar for the first score that he did.
This is what I mean. He could be really big. I mean, like people talk about Hans Zimmer and people like that, and however
he
scores,
he's got his own taste.
Reznor could do this.
Yeah,
and you know it's him.
Yeah, it's got a very specific sound. There's a lot of use of pianos.
That's brilliant.
Plus, no one's ever going to put you on second on the bill on a festival and you get pissed off about it.
Yeah, he ain't going to, is he?
It's a bivvy climber. There's the stuff at the first half of the film, the flashbacks to, you know, Amy's diary entries. It's always this weird sort of eerie, ethereal music.
That's what it's perfect.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And those scenes, the writing felt really artificial and the music helped with that, but it's supposed to be because it was her diary thoughts and it was a fake diary, and the music really complemented that. And then the other bit of the music that stood out for me is the scene where Amy kills Desi, and then all of a sudden the music's just going boom, boom, boom. I thought it was great, and I thought it was unobtrusive. You only noticed it when you needed to notice
exactly.
it. Otherwise it just bedded the film.
There were quite a few bits where it was kind of just in the background noise, just a few kind of, like you said, those ethereal tones, I guess, like you mentioned just then. And it was perfect because you didn't notice it until you think about it. And that's what this film needed, and that's what this film just wanted.
Yeah.
Like, I bought the soundtrack today, and I've got the soundtrack to Social Network, and it's one of those albums that, like you said, it's really subtle, but have a listen to it sometime and just put a track on and start. It might be 6 minutes of just a few sounds, but it's perfect. And the amount of detail that he does... genius. I mean, how much I respect him.
There's one last thing then, one last thing that I want to bring up is we've mentioned a little bit about how Gillian Flynn wrote the script and the novel. And a lot of the reviews and blog posts and whatnot that I've been reading lately is about the misogyny of the film and the misogyny of the book and about how it makes Amy out to be this evil bitch.
Obviously,
which I think is
by Lars von Bellend.
Oh, yeah, true. But, you know, which I find to be an odd accusation when it was written by a woman. You know, if this had been written by a fella, then you could write it off as saying, yeah, he clearly just hates women, he's written this bitch of a character. Gillian Flynn, her argument is, why can't I write a woman who's evil, every bit as evil as... Because in the book, Amy at points, when reading her diary entries, reminds me of Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Not so much in the film, but in the book she does.
That's
so
really
Gillian Flynn is like, why can't I write that for a woman?
I kind of agree with this here, because stereotypically, if we're going to look at it as kind of, you know, stereotyping women in film, they're either the pretty girls.
Yeah, damsel in distress.
Damsel in distress. And even the evil women are always a certain type of evil. They're femme fatales.
Yeah.
Whereas she's a psychopath.
Yeah. Stone cold.
There's not many other characters, like a single white female, or is it Misery, when there's that real sinister woman where you're like, you are sick.
But
like, you scare me.
Nothing on the
but
level
this,
of intellect
this is
that Amy Dunn
has. The thought that she put into that whole revenge.
Yeah, wait, she planned it for a year before
I did not talk to any females today at work. I was like, I was just sitting there in the corner like, I do not, this is horrible.
But I don't see the argument. I think it's a cool argument to level at people nowadays. Everyone who says anything now, you're a misogynist.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't know if we did it with Lars von Trier last week.
Yeah.
But he's
just an arsehole. But Gillian Flynn has written a character for the ages. Amy Dunn is just an evil, stone-cold bitch, and she's brilliant.
If anyone's going to go and watch this film, don't ever go on a date with a girl to watch this film, because it's the worst date film you'll ever go and see.
You will never speak to her again.
No, and you'll probably just walk
and
out.
And you'll be glad of it as well.
Yeah, do not go on a date movie. Take them to see something else.
Wrap this up with a rating then.
Let's give it a rating.
Mark.
No, I'm not going straight away.
All right, then I will. I'm going to give it an 8. I think you've got to be something mind-blowingly special to be a 9, and you've got to be actually perfect to be a 10. This is a very, very good film, which to me, therefore, ranks an 8.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, it was between 8 and 9 for me, I think. Having a bit of time to process it, I'm going to go for an 8 as well. So it's a great film. It's probably going to be up there as one of the films of the year, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's not so much a 9.
I walked into that cinema yesterday. We all know this, I hate using them, but it was Orange Wednesday. Before the film started, I was thinking I'm going to fall out with people. There's people on their phones. For 2.5 hours once that movie started, even the chavvy people, even the arseholes in the cinema that were annoying me, it was silent for 2.5 hours. You could hear a pin drop. I needed a wee about an hour into that film.
Brilliant.
I didn't
move.
On
the console.
Which are available now, no. By far the best film I've seen this year. Better than Guardians. 9.
I couldn't...
The soundtrack.
I rated
the
Guardians.
The acting. There's no CGI. They're not basing it on any Marvel characters. They're not going to make a franchise out of this film. As a standalone film, I've never walked out of the cinema and my brain has not been able to switch off. 24 hours it was since I was in that film. Mm. I've been thinking about it today. Even now, I'll be thinking about this for ages. That was a film that's going to stay with me for a long time.
I'm not going to sit there and compare Gone Girl to Guardians of the Galaxy.
That was our highest rated
that's
film on this
enough.
Podcast.
Yeah,
and for me, this tops it.
Okay. And you gave that 9, though, didn't you?
Yes.
This is slightly higher.
I'm not going 10.
No.
It's a higher 9 than
this. This is a 9.5 in my opinion.
Based,
I absolutely loved it.
Based on the bullshit illogical maths we invented last week, a 9 and 2 8s means it's an 8.
It's an 8, and I'm happy with that. I'll go with an 8, but this is the best film I've seen this year.
Cool. Well, let's see if we can beat that. We've got, what, 2 months left? 2.5 months left?
Good luck, Turtles, next week.
Good luck, Kevin Smith's Tusk.
And good luck, Christopher Nolan with Interstellar.
Oh, yeah.
Mark, you mentioned earlier about how when we went to see Gone Girl, the whole cinema was quiet for the 2.5 hour running time in the film, and how on a certain phone company Wednesdays, that's not often the case. You do tend to get a lot of dickheads. And that got me thinking, about general cinema etiquette. And about how you get a lot of specific kinds of characters. We had a chap, in fact, sitting directly in front of us prior to the film starting, who was making very loud and annoying jokes at the trailers.
Yeah.
Now, it's all well and good making stupid jokes to your friends. Lord knows we do it, but we do it at a volume that only three of us can hear. Is there any need to be the comedian
every week.
And that? Is there any need to be the comedian in the middle of the cinema that tries to entertain the 200 people who are in there?
No, there isn't. And I just remember him sitting there after every trailer going, that'll be the best film since Inception.
Yeah, that was his top line, wasn't it? Yeah. That'll be the best film since Inception.
And I'm not sure whether he was joking because it was a terrible film. I think it was Ouija or something like that.
Oh yeah, Ouija board, yeah.
Whatever it is. But one that's been better film since Inception. So I don't know why that's his reference point.
The funny thing was that after he'd said that a couple of times, the next trailer was for Interstellar, yeah. Which shut him up because he couldn't say it then. The joke wouldn't work.
Well, surprisingly, he's here today.
I think after Interstellar, I actually sort of said very loudly near him, now comes the actual best film since
Inception. Yeah. And another odd one that I had in the cinema, my brother and I, we went to the cinema to see, I forget what it was, I think it was the Lego movie actually, and we went at a time, I think it was during the school holidays or something like that, and it was empty. It was just my brother and I. And then this fella came in with his kid. Me and my brother, we sat right in the middle of the cinema, sort of midway from left to right, midway from top to bottom. This fella and his kid then sat directly behind us, the two seats on the row directly behind us. The rest of the cinema was empty. Do you not find that just odd behaviour? Would you not at least put a barrier of a row or move down a couple of
seats? I think
something?
It'd be weirder if he sat next to you.
True. Like odd people on the
or
bus.
Or just next to your brother.
Yeah.
And his kid was at the front.
But don't you think if you had like this multiplex room to yourself,
definitely,
wouldn't sit that close to the only other two people
in
there?
I'll make a point of putting a row like you said
exactly.
In between us.
You know, there's no rule. I don't want to turn into Larry David here, but this is just social etiquette, isn't it? There are things you do that don't need to be written down. So that one weirds me out.
I'm getting really wound up with the cinema. I know part of this podcast is that we go to the cinema every other week. Luckily, we've been to see some films like Most Wanted Man, where it was only us in the cinema. We were
be a
so
lot of people.
Fortunate.
Yeah. And we do try and avoid
And
Wednesday
we've obviously not gone to see something like Inbetweeners, which would be rammed, but I can't stand it. I mean, I really was thinking last night that it was going to continue with so many knobheads talking throughout Gone Girl.
Well, I mean, I must say that halfway through Gone Girl, what I can only describe as a woman running into the back of my chair. I couldn't believe it. I was just enjoying the film, kind of engrossed in the whole story, and then bang.
Yeah.
What really annoys me is,
I mean, if you are going to get up in the middle of a film and go to the toilet, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Just be careful and don't start knocking everyone's chair.
Yeah.
What really annoys me is the people that have to, for some reason, answer their phone or start texting. And you're in a film, it's 2 hours. What's really going to happen in 2 hours that you can't, unless they ring to say your mum and dad are dead. But, you know, realistically, the fact that they pull their phone out, and I've honestly been in the cinema and someone, all right, mate, yeah, I'm in the cinema. Oh, yeah, about an hour yet. And I'm like, seriously, mate, shut the hell up. You know what I mean? I do not understand why you think it's fine to pretend this is your lounge.
Yeah.
And it's why spend £8 or £9 to see this film, to literally sit there and talk. And I've never got to the point where I'm not tough or anything. I can't turn around and say, oi, shut the hell up or beat you up. You know, I'd get my head kicked in. But
well, it's a dark room if you do it.
Yeah, I get to the point where I just want to not go to the cinema anymore.
And do you know what I hate in cinemas and in life? Children. Especially children who have parents who don't know how to control them. Kids are idiots. This is a fact. An idiot kid is probably going to kick my seat from behind. That's what they do. They're morons. It's up to their parent, the adult in the relationship, to tell them to pack it in. And when a parent just sits there and allows their kid to randomly boot my chair to ruin my enjoyment of the film, that's what winds me the hell up.
Yep.
This is a bit of an offload rant.
It is a bit.
Yeah.
Luckily, Gone Girl is an 18 and there were no kids in there.
Thankfully, yeah.
But no, the cinema experience is getting worse and worse.
And don't eat crisps in the cinema. Don't eat anything crunchy. I'll admit I had nachos yesterday.
Yeah, but
the
you wolfed them down.
I wolfed them down. Before even the goddamn trailer started, I'd eaten those damn nachos. I had some respect.
It gets worse. Some people bring in their own crisps and rucksacks and stuff and suddenly,
what
are you doing?
I mean,
family-sized bag of Doritos.
I mean, cinemas generally sell the noisiest food in the world anyway.
Mm.
They don't actually sell crisps. I think they're more trying to focus on the nachos.
There's not a big enough profit margin on selling crisps. That would be why they don't sell
them. I really hate is, I'm not sure if they still do, but the cinema that we went to last night, in the director's hall, they have, actually sells food in there.
Yeah, so you can have like a...
You can have a steak.
Yeah.
And then all you hear is a knife and fork hitting a plate.
Nice.
Terrible.
But who's noise. Yeah. Who's going to the cinema and thinking, well, I could have dinner in a movie, or I could have dinner while I'm watching the movie in the cinema.
Stick
and
the plate
piss
out.
Everyone else off.
Yeah.
What we should have done is recorded this section in a cinema.
Loudly in the middle of Gone Girl.
And the most annoying thing in the cinema is when I'm trying to film it on my camera and someone knocks me or walks past.
I mean, can they not see the red light?
I know.
But I agree with exactly the point you're making. I think cinema etiquette is a big thing and more people need to learn it. They should start screening people before they actually go in.
Yeah. Just don't go on Wednesdays.
And don't let kids in.
We had a question by Thomas Hill last week on the podcast about our favourite guilty pleasure films. I'm going to kick off with mine, which is a Christmas film called Jingle All the Way, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a workaholic mattress salesman who has to get his kid the last Turbo Man doll for Christmas. It's the latest superhero. And it is an absolute die-on-your-ass film. It is awful, but I love it. I watched it... I think probably about 1998 when it came out as a kid, and loved it. Loved every minute of it. It is terrible. Sinbad, I believe, plays the villain called Myron.
It is Sinbad, yeah.
And it is just terrible. So, have both of you guys seen this film?
I've not seen it, and it's not going to be my homework before we start. No, I've not seen it.
I've seen it multiple times. So I think, like you, I probably end up watching it whenever it comes on.
Exactly.
Knowing that I will enjoy it to a degree. Yeah.
And I just end up watching it. I mean... I actually went and did a bit of research on the film because I thought, you know, it's my guilty pleasure. I want to come here with at least one little fact about it.
Yeah.
And I ended up reading that apparently the character of Myron, originally played by Sinbad, the director chose Sinbad ahead of Joe Pesci for the role.
They're very similar. I can just imagine Sinbad in Goodfellas.
I just remember sitting there thinking... Who chooses Sinbad over Joe Pesci?
Maybe get those universes to actually join forces now. It's just any writers out there?
Hopefully they might kill Sinbad.
Brilliant.
His career's dead.
But when I read that, I just sat there thinking, surely that director's not gone on to do anything else if his major casting choice in that film was, we'll have Sinbad, not Joe Pesci. Who the hell's Joe Pesci anyway?
Did you then look up to see if that director had gone on to do anything else?
I just felt... insulted by the music, by the whole film industry at that stage. I thought, how can you put a man in charge of a film who makes that decision? So that, I mean, that's my guilty pleasure. Mark's not seen it. He refuses to watch it.
Yeah.
If it was at Christmas time, I'd watch it for my homework, but I'm sorry, I'm not in the mood to go.
Okay, well, we'll keep that on note then.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll keep that on note. Yeah.
For the Christmas podcast episode, you'll have to watch that as your homework.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Because we'll no doubt we'll have a very strong Christmas theme, so we'll all end up with Christmas homework. That's yours.
So that'll be yours. Okay, right. Mark?
So, for me, it's going to be The Devil Wears Prada.
I like that film as well.
Oh, okay, that's all right then, good.
It's a good movie, man.
If I admitted that to a group of my mates down the pub, I'd probably get a lot of funny looks and what? But I like that film. It's all about the fashion industry and how catty it can be. And have you seen it, Adam?
No, I'm not going to.
I don't believe you. I think you have seen it. You just don't want to admit it.
Nope. I've been too busy watching films with Vin Diesel, Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Manly films.
So, you know.
No, it's a great film. A lot of people will pan it. It's definitely a film that wouldn't be alongside the normal sort of films I watch. But it's my guilty pleasure. I've watched it a few times. I think Anne Hathaway in it's fantastic. Meryl Streep's the kind of bad guy, well, the bad lady in it, who's the manager of the... firm that she goes to work for, and she's really really awful to work for, but in the end she's not so bad. But it's cheesy, it shouldn't be a film that should even be in my DVD collection, but I own up in front of all those listeners. I'm sorry, I hands up, it was my guilty pleasure.
The only thing I actually, like, I don't really know anything about this film, I've never seen it before, I'm not going to see it, I have no interest in seeing it.
Alright, we get it, you don't want to see it.
But I just remember the bit in the US Office series where Pam talks about Michael watching it, and he comes in and he tries to play like the Meryl Streep character.
Yeah.
And I think it takes him about a week and then figures out that Meryl Streep's character is the bad guy in it. And then he just gets really upset about it.
He apologises to Pam.
And that's the only thing I know about that film.
Well, yeah, that's my guilty pleasure. So over to you, Ben.
So my guilty pleasure film is Southland Tales. Have either of you heard of it?
Yeah.
I have no idea. The title rings a bell, but I have no idea.
It was the follow-up to Donnie Darko, the director of Donnie Darko, Richard Kelly. He'd had great success with Donnie Darko. It wasn't a big hit.
I think he served me at McDonald's, yeah.
He may have done, based on his career trajectory. Yeah. It wasn't a great hit, Donnie Darko, but it was a cult film and people loved it. So there was a lot of anticipation about the follow-up to that. And he did this film called Southland Tales, which is set in Los Angeles after an apocalyptic war that's destroyed half of America, and it's about how various citizens interact. Okay. And it's just a really bizarre, trippy, funny film that stars The Rock
as
an action movie star with amnesia, and he runs into Sarah Michelle Gellar, who plays a psychic porn star. Surely you see
already. I'm going home tonight. I'm watching this.
Yeah, it's just,
I'm not going to take it as homework, but I am going to watch it.
It's an utterly ridiculous film. There's a scene in it where Justin Timberlake's in it as well. And there's a scene where there's a musical number where he lip syncs to All the Things That I've Done by The Killers for no apparent reason. There's no real storyline reason for it, but the film it's just hilarious, and it got absolutely panned at the reviews. On Rotten Tomatoes, it's got 36%. On Metacritic, it's got 44%. It was critically reviled.
That is...
But I love it. But yeah, Richard Kelly hasn't worked since. And you say you saw him in McDonald's.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be remotely surprised. Sorry, Richard.
So, thanks to everyone that contributed on Facebook, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. We've had quite a few come through this week, so thank you. We've got Ben Slaughter with Hudson Hawk and Jaws 3D. I've not seen Hudson Hawk.
Bruce Willis film, I quite like that as well.
Good.
It is rubbish, but I quite like it.
Natalie Brown has said The Mummy and Tremors. Well, Tremors is one of the greatest films ever made, so I'm sorry, Natalie, you are not having that as a guilty pleasure.
Yeah, it wasn't in your top five films of all time.
Big claim that it's one of the greatest films ever made.
Chris Jones, this is a film that I love, Clueless.
I can see why people think it's a
lot of people.
It's a lot like Mean Girls. Yeah. People think it's a guilty pleasure, but it's actually an incredible
good
film.
We had so many people come through with Mean Girls. Tony Ridley, Titanic.
No, he's wrong. That's just a terrible film.
But wasn't that critically acclaimed?
Yeah, but it's shit.
Sean Butler again for Hudson Hawk. Stuart Pickering, Still Crazy. Still Crazy. What?
Oh, that's the film. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. Still Crazy since last week. Ben Sinclair, McDonald, The Thomas Crown Affair.
Okay.
That's alright.
James, there's two, isn't there? Wasn't it a
remake?
The remake,
yeah. Put that on the DVD cover, it's alright.
Yeah, for Mark. James Howe, Pearl Harbor. Do you know what? It's
terrible.
It's terrible. But...
I thought that was going to be there.
Do you know what?
It's terrible.
The only thing I think about with that is Team America, when they did that whole song about Ben Affleck and Cuba Gooding Jr.
Nicholas Eversfield, Dragonheart.
I don't remember that.
I kind of see, yeah, it's a bad film. But when I was younger, I enjoyed that as well.
And finally, Mark Holloway, Pretty Woman. You're only saying that, I reckon, to try and get laid.
Yeah.
Well, that's
outrageous
it.
Outrageous claim.
After many internet rumours, loads of speculation, it's official. Ghostbusters is going to be rebooted. Today the news is official, right? Paul Feig, you know, the guy who's famous for Bridesmaids?
Yep.
He's officially being signed today to do the reboot of Ghostbusters. More importantly, it's been announced it's going to be an all-female team.
Right.
So we're not going to see probably Dan Aykroyd, we're not going to see... All the original cast.
No, Bill Murray.
None of the original cast. Maybe cameos, we don't know. But
I reckon
yeah.
Ernie Hudson will be in it. He's got nothing else to do.
Probably a comic con
with
Virgil.
Probably turn up in it.
But yeah, we're not going to get to see what we probably wanted, which was part three of the Ghostbusters. It's a reboot. What are your thoughts, boys?
Well, before we get into the all-female cast, you're brilliant when Mark mentioned Paul Feig. Sounded very sarcastic, Adam.
No.
Sounded it. If you're worried about his directing credentials, because...
I just don't like Bridesmaids.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're not a fan of Bridesmaids. It's a film I like,
what,
I really enjoy.
Or...
Yeah.
No, I love Bridesmaids.
But Paul Feig has actually got really good credentials, especially on the small screen. He's a guy that's directed multiple episodes of 30 Rock, Arrested Development,
okay.
Parks and Recreation, and something that I know you love is The American Office.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as he even directed the episode Goodbye Michael, which was the episode where Michael Scott,
okay.
Steve Carell, left the show, which is a brilliantly directed episode.
I love Parks and Rec, and I do love America. I've not really seen much of 30 Rock, if I'm completely honest with you. But, yeah, okay, if he's got those sort of credentials, fair enough.
Yeah.
And I'd be quite happy if the all-female cast included people like Aubrey Plaza and Amy Poehler and Tina Fey, because...
Oh, yeah.
All very funny women.
Yeah, absolutely.
Aubrey Plaza I absolutely love, by the way.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
The only news that's come out so far is that Ernie Hudson has basically come out today and said he's not behind the idea. He thinks it's a real bad idea that the female...
So when you said that...
Yeah.
He's got nothing else to do, he'll probably be in it.
He's not a fan, he says it shouldn't be happening from the start, it shouldn't be a reboot, and an all-female film is not a good idea, and that's official.
Ooh, sexist. He's been hanging out with Lars.
Crazy. I'm a massive fan of Ghostbusters.
Yeah, I think everyone is.
It's a brilliant movie, the sequel's awesome as well.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this news. I know you've just made a really good point that he's directed some of our favourite TV, but no, this should have been
It's left. A difficult skill to translate it, especially with a topic like Ghostbusters.
Well, the massive rumour for me was that they were going to do Ghostbusters 3. It's been talked about. Yeah. People have always said, like, Bill Murray didn't quite want the script.
I wonder if the plans for that changed.
Dan Aykroyd wasn't behind it.
Then no, I think Dan Aykroyd was in. Dan Aykroyd wanted it. It was Bill Murray who didn't want anything to do with it.
Really?
The worry I had, the fact that this is a complete reboot, I don't like the idea of it being all women. And I'm not trying to be Lars von Trier here. I just, you know, to me, the Ghostbusters are four fellas. Maybe have one or two women in there, you know, token. But this, to me, I think it's better than the idea that's been floated for the best part of a decade, which was part three was going to be the older guys passing the baton to a new set
kids
of guys.
Or whatever,
yeah, and I didn't like that idea because of the names that had been mooted for it. It was like it was going to be Seth Rogen... Jonah Hill, Ben Stiller, you know, just
that'd
the
worst
usual.
Film
exactly.
Ever.
And that's what has been going around Adam for Sandler. Some time, probably Adam Sandler, yeah. That's the sort of shit that's been going around for a long time. So at least this is new and fresh and different, so it has a chance to stand alone and be its own thing.
It could be good. I mean, like we've mentioned just then, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Aubrey Plaza, Rashida Jones has worked with.
Rashida Jones would be great.
Yeah, all of these people could be brilliant.
What's the large lady from Bridesmaids?
Melissa McCarthy.
There's an official statement that she's going to be involved in the writing.
I'm done.
And that is official. I believe she was involved in, was it The Heat with Sandra Bullock?
Which was directed by Paul Feig.
Yeah, so there's elements that could work.
I think the odds are then that she's clearly going to be in Ghostbusters if she's been in Paul Feig's last two big films.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of her.
I'm really not a fan of this news.
We've got to
give it time and see.
I'm going to treat it with a similar... Where I treated RoboCop when I heard that was coming out. Doesn't need a reboot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, doesn't need a reboot.
On the subject.
I've heard Dread's not actually that bad. Not
it's fantastic.
The more recent Dread film is really good.
But there's certain franchises that don't need a reboot.
Like the Spider-Man franchise, which they reboot every 8 minutes.
Apparently they're planning to reboot that again.
There we go.
And on the subjects of reboots, as you know, Teenage Turtles will be rebooted with Michael Bay behind the... Megan Fox. And we will actually be reviewing that next week on the podcast.
Right then, guys, so we had our homework set last week. I had Singles, directed by Cameron Crowe.
I had Dazed and Confused by Richard Linklater.
And I had Control by Anton Corbin.
Cool. Okay, Mark, well, we'll start with you then.
So, yeah, after watching Most Wanted Man, it came about that I'd not seen any other work from Anton Corbin, so this film was all about the life and times of Joy Division and mostly focused around the life of Ian Curtis, the frontman. I'm not a massive fan of Joy Division. I've heard a lot of their songs. I know they're up there with the likes of the Smiths and
Rage. Said one of those bands from kind of the 80s, aren't they, where everyone kind of raves about them. They're always up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had no idea about the background of the band, so it was a real good insight to the life and times. For me, brilliant film. Filmed in black and white, really British. Had a real good gritty British feel about it. Anton Corbin, great directing, really felt like it was actually Joy Division I was watching. Really, really impressed with Sam Riley's take on Ian Curtis. Like I said, I just felt I was watching the life and times of actual Ian Curtis. Great acting, great sort of performance all round. Really enjoyed it.
Okay. It's a shame, actually, because at the time when it came out, I really enjoyed it. I watched it not long after it came out. And a lot of the talk was about how great Sam Riley's performance was and how he's going to be the next big thing, and I don't think he's really caught fire yet. And I don't think that's his fault. He might just not have picked the right parts, or casting directors might not have liked him. But I still think he's destined for bigger things. But I thought he was great as Ian Curtis.
Yeah, what really kind of opened my eyes up in this was how depressed and what a struggle the life of Ian Curtis was being in that band. So, to cut a long story short, they got signed. It was quite a quick thing for them. They were one of the biggest bands around, and overnight they got to tour America, became the biggest sort of band around. Not on the scale of the Beatles, but for a British band, they did bloody well.
Yeah.
And he pretty much hated the whole experience. He was struggling with kind of depression. I think he was epileptic because he kept having fits, and his whole life was really bleak and really down, and he had a child, a missus that he didn't really connect with, and his life on the road, you expect this band to be out getting drunk, sleeping with groupies, the proper rock and roll lifestyle. It probably was for the remaining members of the band, but for Ian, it just seemed one big struggle. He was really depressed, really down.
This might seem like a glib comparison, but do you see any similarities between him and Kurt Cobain?
Good question.
Because they're both in these hugely successful bands, introverted, depressed guys who ended up killing themselves.
Again, it kind of happened for Nirvana overnight-ish.
I'm not so much of a scale of Nirvana, but it was not the fun life that we all dream of as a kid, you know, wanting to be the next James Hetfield or Kurt Cobain. You're right.
And I guess it's just not for everyone, is it? I mean, a lot of people join a band because they want to be in a band, they want to create music. And, you know, the whole touring aspect isn't for... I mean, look at Nirvana and Dave Grohl. He's gone on to be in Foo Fighters. He tours. He loves touring.
Yeah.
He loves producing music. So, yeah.
It is for him.
Some people are built for that lifestyle, and some people just aren't.
Even though he's got kids and a wife and stuff, he still happens to go around the world touring. Foo Fighters just take, 2 years off recently, a year off recently, just to make an album and stay at home.
Yeah, I think for Ian Curtis, it was the pressure.
Yeah.
I think because he was the front man, pretty much the songwriter, and it's like Morrissey and everyone else, the lyrics, it's so personal.
Yeah.
It's such a big thing for him. And in this film, you see, even to the last moment when he actually commits suicide, it's just such a sad story, because if you only heard them on CD and watched a few live performances, you have no idea. The way he is as a front man, it's all false, it's all fake.
Yeah.
He's wearing a mask and kind of, not like Slip not wearing a mask, as in, the way he comes across, you think he's up there with like kind of Sex Pistols, real confident front man, but as soon as those lights go off, he is literally the worst person you want to be around. And, you know, a really good film, really enjoyed it. I'm glad you recommended it, and I recommend it to anyone to go and watch out there. But very bleak, really big eye-opener, and it will make me go and visit more records now from Joy Division, because...
Oh, that's good, if anything, takes you back to their music.
Yeah. I want to go now and listen, because obviously you see these people, not just the annoying people in Starbucks that wear a T-shirt to think they're cool with the...
Can't even name five tracks from the
band. Yeah, exactly, but it makes me want to go back and... Well, there's a lot of fuss about them, so I really want to give them a little more... Yeah, exactly, I want to go and give them the time they deserve.
Cool.
So, yeah, I...
Enjoyed it then?
Good film.
Right, shall I go next?
Yeah, go on.
My pick was Dazed and Confused, which I believe was given to me, Mark, because it was one of your favourite soundtracks of all time.
Yeah.
And I can say quite clearly and quite plainly, the soundtrack is the only thing about it that I didn't hate.
What about Ben Affleck?
It was really amusing to see a very young Ben Affleck, a 21-year-old Ben Affleck, playing a meathead, paddling kids' arses with like a cricket bat-style paddle, and seeing a very young Matthew McConaughey as well in the film where he invented his all right catchphrase.
Yeah.
So seeing them was good, but a film that was set in 1976, a coming-of-age high school film, I can't really connect to it on many levels. One, I wasn't around in the 70s, didn't live through it, and two, I've never lived that particular brand of American high school life.
Yeah.
British high school, British senior school, it was not the same thing. We didn't have hazing and freshmen and sophomores and all that kind of, and seniors. That's just not the way it worked for us. It's a very different lifestyle. So I couldn't really relate to the film. Also, there was the fact that there was actually no story. Nothing happened. It was the events of a series of teenagers over the course of one night, none of which were particularly interesting. It was them just smoking weed, drinking beers. Like, you know, I could go out into the town centre or to several of my friends' houses and see that behaviour. I don't want to watch a film for it. But the soundtrack was quite good. You know, you had Paranoid by Black Sabbath, one of my all-time favourite tunes. You had a couple of Lynyrd Skynyrd songs. There was an Aerosmith song back when Aerosmith weren't terrible, i.e. the 70s.
Yeah.
So the soundtrack was pretty cool, but the rest of it did not do a goddamn thing for me, I'll be quite honest with you.
So cool, glad you really enjoyed it.
So that's 2 weeks in a row, you've saddled me with shit homework. It's getting to the point where this actually feels like homework now, which is not the intention.
We've actually lost listeners over your Indiana Jones comments.
We've had someone come through on Facebook saying they've unsubscribed because they can't believe you didn't like Indiana Jones. But
deal with it.
Yeah.
But on the plus side, they won't be listening to this. So.
So I'm sorry, Ben, you didn't like that film. Ben Affleck is so good at it. He's such an arsehole.
He is a real arsehole. He's only in like three scenes, but yeah, he is pretty good in it. But yeah, otherwise,
think he,
I just didn't care.
Would that top his Gone Girl performance?
It's close. It's not quite as good.
So Adam, singles.
Yeah, again, soundtrack, very good.
Mate, Pearl Jam.
Rest of the film, not so much.
Fair enough. Very early Cameron Crowe.
It honestly felt like a chore to watch.
Yeah.
It just felt like a very long episode of Friends set in Seattle. Okay. It's all about these people who are, you know, trying to get together, they're not sure. Then all of a sudden it's, you know, one guy realises that he does love the woman even though he's treating her badly throughout the entire... I didn't like it, I'll be honest.
Do you believe, guys, and this isn't like trying to get out of it, but do you believe it's one of those films that, because I watched it 10 years ago, I was
maybe
drinking more, going to parties, never smoke drugs, that'd be awful, but you know, doing the sort of things that I could relate more to these films. I was a lot more into the music scene, gigging.
Quite possibly.
Yeah, it's that whole thing of,
You relate to it. Yeah. In a way that I didn't relate to Dazed and Confused, and Adam quite probably didn't relate to singles.
No,
you related to that.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's weird. I'm not saying it's a bad film.
No.
I'm just saying I didn't enjoy it. There are probably people out there who would enjoy it.
For me, 10 years ago, to go, oh my God, when my favourite band's Pearl Jam are in a movie, of course I'm going to love it, even if they just
there'll
went
be,
up
there'll
and
be people who were 20-something-year-olds in 1992 Seattle that would be like, oh my God, that was my life.
Exactly. And to seize on something you just said there, Dazed and Confused, I think it was rubbish, but that's my personal opinion. It's in Quentin Tarantino's top 10 films of all time, I believe.
Yeah.
So, that, you know,
it's such a cult film.
Yeah.
I can clearly see how people would like it.
Well, next week's homework, boys, I hope is going to be a lot better for you.
Well, it's going to be great.
As a reminder, Ben...
My homework is David Fincher's Seven, a film that it is quite ridiculous that I've not seen.
That's going to be completely different to Dazed and Confused.
Yep, yeah. I've got The Jerk. Come on, Mark.
Zodiac. What a week.
Beautiful.
People on our Facebook and Twitter have come with some questions this week, so thanks for that. Again, a reminder, on Twitter it's at STTE Podcast. If you want to email us, that old school emailing, it's skiptotheend@icloud.com. And on Facebook, it's facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. We've had 3 questions come through, so you guys have got no idea what these are.
That's the quick fire round.
Yeah. Jack Willits, first question is, your favourite Arnold Schwarzenegger movie?
He's already had Jingle All The Way.
Yeah, well, you've got to think of something else. Your favourite film he's ever done?
Total Recall.
I see, this is really difficult.
I'm going with either Twins, and I'm not... I know what you're going to say. You're going to say Ice to Meet You.
He's not going to say that.
The Sixth Day.
That's crap, isn't it?
I'm going to go with Predator.
Total Recall for me.
Yeah, you know what? Predator probably is my favourite as well.
Cool.
Hope that's answered your question. Thanks, nice short one. Your most ever watched film... This is from Andy Woodcliffe on Facebook. So I'm not talking you going to the cinema and watching Dark Knight 10 times. Think about
times?
A film you've watched
still probably is the dark
again and again and again. If this was an iTunes of films, what would be that one that...
For me, it's probably a tie between Anchorman and Empire Strikes Back.
I'd probably say Shaun of the Dead. I think I must have watched that film more than any other.
Mine's going to be Groundhog Day. My dad, for a kid, for some reason...
Quite ironically.
Watch this, yeah. Last question. This is from Twitter, which I've at the user tag is at 532117EF. Tell me your top 3 directors of all time.
Oh, we can't do this one now. That's got to be.
So this
that's
is
gotta
a,
be for next week.
Think about this.
Yeah,
come back next week. I know it's all probably going to be Lars. But, no, Think about it. That's a great topic for next week.
That's brilliant, and it's surprising to me we've not done that yet. But that's perfect.
Last week we talked about the work and quite a big outrage about Lars von Trier, about how much we hated him, how much he wound us up. We've had a bit of a response on Facebook. A few of my friends have said, oh, he's all right, give him a try, at least he's pushing boundaries.
They don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, we're happy to say we're never going to change our mind on that.
Tell him to go back to Starbucks and shut the fuck up.
Well, it's funny you say that, because this is my thing that's got me thinking this week, and I want you to both take some time out and come back next week, a bit of a talking point. It's not really a challenge, but I think Lars is one of those people that's cool to like.
I like how you're on first name terms with him now as well.
Me and Lars, me and the L-dog. But yeah, me and Lars, he's that cool person to like. Now, there's some certain films out there that I think are cool to like. So films like, what's that silent film? The Artist. People are like, oh, it's amazing, it's great. It's not, it's pretentious bollocks. I want you both to go away and think about those films that are just utter bollocks, but it's cool to like. And everyone would, if you went into Starbucks tomorrow, there's a guy with his iPad, wearing a scarf in the summer, little
hipster
top hat,
glasses.
Yeah.
Thinking he's cool, probably a little sign up saying willing to listen and drinking his skinny latte.
So
what's
Starbucks
the film?
Yeah. Can I just state at this point that not all hipster pricks go to Starbucks.
And they also get a Costa.
And not everyone who goes to Starbucks is a hipster.
No. Prick. What's that film that's just the cool film to like? So let's be honest about it. Let's not try and be cool. We're not.
Okay.
Let's
so you want us to come back next time around with the one film each that we can think of that is the arty farty, hip, cool film to like that we all know is actually shit. It's that time of the proceedings again where we go to the DVD challenge. The challenge that I set for you guys last week was to find the worst rip-off movie, or so that we don't get sued, the worst homage movie. But since we set this challenge, I've actually found that there's a real term, there's a Wikipedia entry for this. They're known as mockbusters.
Brilliant.
Which I think is fantastic. So guys, what do we get? Mark, let's start with you.
Okay, this is probably the most fun I've ever had on a challenge yet in five episodes. There's so much shit out there, it's unreal.
You're not wrong.
So the first one, AVH, Alien vs. Hunter.
That's a rip-off.
I'm going to interject here. I've actually talked about this film on a previous podcast. I've seen it.
Right, we're going to, because I love these sort of films, I probably own most of them on Steelbook, we're going to move on to the next one. The Terminators.
Is this the Aliens sequel?
A small band of resistance fighters battle the cyborgs that have taken over the planet. Yep,
very
good. Do you think James Cameron's going to sue anyone over that? And my favourite, Snakes on a Train.
Brilliant.
A zombie curse is placed upon a woman, which causes her to have living snakes inside her. This is true.
Yeah.
Brujo, who is looking after
story?
Her, yeah, attempts to take her to Los Angeles on a train. That's it. What? On a train? So what happens? The cover's basically a tunnel, but if you look closely, it's the fangs and the eyes of a snake.
I'm fed up with these mother effing snakes on this mother effing train.
And the one I had to leave off, I'm going to milk this and get as many as I can. Transmorphers.
Brilliant.
What's that about?
Well, I think that's your homework.
No.
So yeah, brilliant challenge. Keep them coming.
Okay, I'm going to go with one that is quite clearly a homage. A mockbuster.
Yeah.
And it's following on from last week's podcast, Alan Quatermain and the Temple of Skulls.
Are you serious?
Yes. He's basically, I imagine, some kind of archaeologist with a hap and a whip.
Yeah.
Who, invades his Temple of Skulls. Do I really need to say more? I think we all know.
Well, obviously that's a play on Indiana Jones.
Is it?
Well, and doesn't Sean Connery play Indiana Jones' dad in one of the later films?
Yes.
Sean Connery also played Alan Quatermain in Leap of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Brilliant.
A little bit of a connection for you there, boys. What do you think?
Incredible.
Fantastic.
And Skull, King of Crystal Skull, they're bringing it in early.
And my second one I found was a film called Abraham Lincoln versus Zombies.
That's supposed to be alright.
No,
genuinely.
Abraham Lincoln versus Vampire Hunters.
No, it's still supposed to be alright as far as they go. That one's supposed to be not too bad.
But what I want to do is I just want to read out the final scene from Abraham Lincoln versus Zombies, because this actually made me laugh out loud.
Featuring Gabe.
Actually made me laugh out loud. 18 months later, Abe goes to visit Mary, who has been in the care of a doctor investigating the illness of becoming a zombie. This is in the vain hope of finding a cure. As Abe cleans wounds caused by resisting her shackles, she grabs his hand and scratches him in the skin, infecting him. Uh-huh. Knowing he's incurable, Abe requests that a message be sent to John Wilkinson, as he'd early discovered that Wilkinson was actually John Wilkes Booth, who had a plot to kidnap Lincoln in response to the end of the war. The message gives Booth the information to know exactly where Lincoln is, so he can be assassinated, so he doesn't turn into a zombie.
Spoilers. Wow.
What storytelling?
Ben, top it.
Right, so I set this challenge, so I decided to subvert the challenge. I've only found one. I knew you guys were going to go for the stereotypical mockbusters, which is what I asked you to do. You know, when I set up, what was it?
It wasn't hard work, man. Android I just went for my DVD collection.
But I decided to go for a very different kind of film. The ones we've just spoken about there are quite clearly piss takes. The studios that made the studios that make them know about it. The studios that made the originals know they're spoofs. They don't care. This was a film that wasn't made as a joke. It was made as a genuine film. It was called Mac and Me. Now, I'm going to give you the synopsis for this. Eric's new in the neighbourhood. Mac's new on the planet. Mac is the mysterious alien creature. Now, do you get that? Mac. Mysterious alien creature. Yeah. mysterious alien creature that finds himself accidentally sucked up by a space probe and brought back to Earth with his family. When they become separated, Mac heads off to discover this new planet with hilarious results and finds a new friend in 10-year-old Eric. So, alien lands on Earth.
Cool.
Young friend. What do we think this is a shameless rip-off of?
One of those Spielberg films, maybe?
Titanic.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. It was quite obviously a shameless rip-off of E.T. And it crashed and burned at the box office. It was an absolute disaster piece. It has a rating of 3.4 on IMDb, just in case
good
you
rating.
Want to watch it.
Good rating. Should we watch it?
No, let's not. And one of the things that it was slated for is that it's just a shocking showcase for product placement. Like, you know, in E.T. there's that one scene with the Reese's Pieces.
Yeah.
In Mac and Me, Mac only eats Skittles.
Oh, God.
There's a scene in Mac and Me as well where there's a 5-minute dance routine between him and Ronald McDonald in a McDonald's. Ronald McDonald, who in the trailers is credited as himself.
Jesus.
You see Coca-Cola cans and bottles every 2 minutes. It's a ridiculous
rip-off. Worse than iRobot.
It bombed. It's an absolute piece of shit.
Brilliant.
Let's be honest with it.
Right, guys, it feels like a long time since I've set you both a challenge. I really like the wrestling challenge we did a couple of weeks ago.
Well, we wrestled each other.
Yeah, you said you wouldn't talk about that.
Oh, sorry.
I won.
So, this time I want you to go out there and find a film with a famous rock star. That simple.
Can I have singles with Pearl Jam?
No, you don't want it.
The worst kind of not-so-famous rock star would be better. So if you can find those cameos where it may be the
clearly
second guitarist or Iron Maiden or someone, but something to do with a famous rock star or a member of a band that's gone and tried his luck in acting.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool challenge, and one I don't think will be difficult for us to find.
No.
There are going to be dozens, if Brilliant. Not millions.
Challenge accepted?
Challenge accepted.
So that brings us to the end of episode 5 of the Skip to the End podcast. Join us next time where we'll be reviewing the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. We've also got a couple of topics of discussion. We're going to come in and talk about our top 3 directors of all time. We're also going to think of our biggest pretentious hipster art house movie that the Starbucks or other coffee shop drinkers go on about when we really know they're terrible. We've also got our homework. My homework is to watch 7, Mark.
The Zodiac Director's Cut.
And Adam?
I've got to watch The Jerk.
And we've also got, as usual, a DVD challenge where we're going to find the worst film starring a rock star. So thanks a lot for listening. Say goodbye, guys.
Bye.
Cowabunga.